I believe that I'm here for a short period of time, and I'm all about trying to get the most life experiences I can in the time that I have.
Welcome to Learning Life.
And the thing that I've realized, from the CEO to the NFL football player to the janitor, we're our toughest critics and we're hardest on ourselves.
But you have to be willing to say and point out the things that need to be said.
The only way to grab somebody's attention is with a story.
Welcome to Learning Life with John Toda. Today, I'm very happy to kick off this brand new Learning Life local season, where we're focused on the unique entrepreneurs and thought leaders right here in our hometown of Burlington, Vermont. And who better to kick off this season with than the ultimate Burlington entrepreneur himself, Russ Scully. It's tough to pick a starting point with Russ because he's involved in so many business ventures, and he's also one of the greatest supporters of the local entrepreneurial community here in Vermont. With his wife, Roxanne, Russ has co-founded Scully Interactive, as well as the Wind and Waves lifestyle brand and the popular Spot restaurants right here in town. He's also recently launched the amazing Hula Campus, where Russ and his team are building an insanely cool 150,000 square foot campus for startups and established businesses right here on the shores of Lake Champlain. There's so much to talk about with Russ, so I'm excited to get us started. Russ Scully, welcome to Learning Life.
Thank you, John. Happy to be here.
So, you know, you're doing so many different things here in town, and we're talking with entrepreneurs about their experience growing businesses here in Burlington. But what I'd like to start with is, how did you get to Burlington? Are you from this area originally, or was there some reason that brought you to town and building your business over here?
I originally grew up in New Jersey, and I still am. I'm a proud Jersey native. But shortly after that, I that's where I really fell in love with the whole sport of surfing. So surfing is this kind of, as people know, surfing has this way of monopolizing all of your time and pretty much every thought that goes through your brain. At some point, it's beyond addictive, but it's a kind of sport that really kind of takes over every life decision you're ever going to make, because from that point forward, all you can think about is how you can spend more time in the water. And so I learned to surf at around 15, 16 years old, living in New Jersey. And my two best friends from New Jersey were Tom and Ted. And the three of us moved from, we all had a pact that after we finished graduating from college, we're all going to college around the same time. As soon as we got out of college, the plan was to move to California, where we could do more surfing and spend some time out there. And so that was the plan. We stuck to that. But at the trailing years of my time at St. Lawrence University, where I went to school, I met and fell in love with my wife, Roxanne. So Rox and I went to school together. We were great friends going through college together. You could see the curtain falling on the 4 years of college. And we both kind of looked at each other going, hey, we've got a good thing going on here. Let's keep this rolling. And I was madly in love with her and said, listen, I've got this plan with these two friends of mine from New Jersey. We're moving to Santa Barbara. You should come with us. And so she was like, yeah, let's do it. And back then, you know, you're at that age where anything is possible. And so we spent about 5 or 6 years together living in a house, had an amazing time, did a lot of surfing, a lot of riding, a lot of just, and really kind of living a lifestyle where we were burning the candles at both ends. You know, we were all working towards our careers, but we're also having a lot of fun. And it was like those golden moments of like those early 20s where you're just unencumbered and doing whatever you want to do. And then ultimately, I proposed to Roxanne on the beaches of Santa Barbara. And then we looked at each other and said, listen, if we're ever going to see our families again, we probably need to head back east. And at that point, my parents had left New Jersey. They were living in Southern Vermont. And so, I never really saw myself as being a type of person that would really work well in like a metropolitan area. So it was a process of elimination of saying like, I don't want to live in New York. I don't want to live in Boston. Burlington has always been an amazing lifestyle town. We'd been on the beach for 6 years and it was time to kind of go out and do some more snowboarding, skiing and riding and so forth. So we're like, hey, let's give Burlington a try. I hear a lot of good things about it.
Yeah. And so, and it's kind of interesting because as a surfer, you would think that Burlington might not necessarily be the spot where you end up ultimately, but you kind of look at it from a different perspective, I think, with like Wind and Waves and what you're doing there. How are you satisfying that passion for surfing while you're living here in the Burlington area?
Well, it's wild. And like, this is one of the things I think we're trying to do with Wind and Waves, right? Is I really honestly didn't even understand how big Lake Champlain was. When I moved here, it was like the first time I laid eyes on it, I was like, holy cow, this is like an untapped, amazing water sport resource right here. And you know, immediately, and it's, a lot of this is like entrepreneurially minded, right? So immediately I'm thinking like, what can I do with this? And I was so excited to learn to windsurf because I was one, it was a sport. I was, it always intrigued me. It always looked interesting, but I was really, all my time was really devoted and dedicated to surfing. So I really didn't have, I didn't really want to sacrifice any of that time to learn something new. But as soon as I saw Lake Champlain, I was like, that's it. I'm going to learn to windsurf. So I immediately went down, you know, bought a board, bought a sail, and just fell in love with windsurfing. And then just realized like what an opportunistic, amazing resource Lake Champlain is for anybody who loves water sports. And the timing of it worked out really well because right around that time, this whole, well, sometime afterwards, right? But like to get the dates here, like Roxanne and I moved back to Burlington in 1998. I started Wind and Waves in 2009. Throughout that, those 10 years or so, I was getting more and more involved with like windsurfing. And then all of a sudden kiteboarding showed up as a, as this kind of new wind sport that looked even more intriguing. So I got really involved in that. There was a woman named Rachel Miller, who ultimately was like the catalyst who helped me really plan out and execute the whole Wind and Waves brand. Because Rachel was really, she was the on-water person for teaching people to windsurf and kite on Lake Champlain. And then right around the time that she was kind of pivoting to do, she's doing this environmental stewardship stuff where she's really like cleaning the oceans from plastic and identifying plastic and doing all sorts of amazing work to come to like water quality. And she was kind of pivoting towards that. And so right around that time, there was this interesting invite where she got an inquiry from a New York Times writer named Sarah Tuff Dunn, who had gotten an assignment to write a story for the New York Times about stand-up paddling on Lake Champlain. And they really wanted to include the perspective of a user who was not in the industry. And so Rachel said, I know a person who'd be perfect for that. So she connected me with Sarah. We ended up doing this story together, which was really fun. But it ran in the Sunday Times with a color picture of me paddling on Lake Champlain. And all of a sudden, you know, my parents are calling me and they're like, holy cow, we're getting calls from people who are seeing your picture in the Sunday Times. And that was like the defining moment where I became the paddleboard guy for this area. And so I got a ton of questions about stand-up paddleboards. And that was right around the time that Rachel was pivoting. So all of a sudden, you know, this entrepreneurial sort of flicker kicked in again. And I said, all right, I'm going to set up a little shop and I'm going to sell these things. And before all this, I was in the interactive space. So for 15 years, I was running Scully Interactive, which was initially an interactive company, started in 2000, right at the millennium. And we were building websites, and particularly e-commerce websites. So I built an e-commerce platform that I was slowly selling. We'd found a niche early on in like 2001, 2002 in the coffee industry. So we productized this thing called eBeans, and I was going to coffee trade shows, and I was the only guy in the coffee trade shows with a projector. Everyone else is selling like grinders and coffee bags and roasters and things like that. I've got like a screen, a projector, a really small footprint, something that can, a booth that I can literally fly into with just a roller bag and set up. And I was basically selling a turnkey subscription internet service so that for all these roasters, so that they can get like guaranteed recurring revenue from people who are just picking a coffee and having it shipped to them regularly. So I already had that going, and that created a nice little recurring revenue stream for us. And it created, it allowed us to productize our web company so that we weren't out there just shopping and selling web projects over and over and over again. Because the creative economy is challenging, right? It's like you go out and you pitch a project, you win a project, you deliver the project, and then you're right back to the pitching stage again. That hamster wheel was getting really tiring. And after a while, I realized like, I got to get into this SaaS model, this software as a service model, where I can like build one product and then be able to sell that to a niche industry and do it on a recurring revenue basis. And so we did that with eBeans. I called it eBeans and I fell in love with it. It was honestly, at that stage, it was like my third child. You know, I have two boys, Roxanne and I have two boys, and this was like my third kid. It was like, yeah. I was that involved in this. So anyway, but I started to also, you know, not tire of that, but I was like, hey, I think I have some bandwidth to do some other things here. I don't want to spend my life just in the interactive world. And so anyway, this opportunity around stand-up paddling opened. And I said, you know what? I'd also gotten involved in commercial real estate a little bit. So I own this little building on Pine Street before Pine Street really got all that popular. And so I had some extra office space. And so right next to Scully Interactive's office, I set up a tiny little space just to display about 5 paddleboards. And that's where it started. And then I would have people just like walk in and start asking me about paddleboards. And that's how Wind and Waves grew. And ultimately, we moved that next door. That was a Meineke muffler shop. that owner came to me one day and he goes, so what are you doing here? What's the deal? Are you interested in buying more buildings? Are you going to do more interactive stuff? Are you doing paddling stuff? What's your deal? And I was like, listen, you know, I'm not in a hurry to sort of grow any sort of commercial real estate portfolio, but if you're interested in selling, I would certainly want to know. Anyway, we ended up buying that building from him, renovating that thing, and then ultimately Windy Wave moved into that along with a few other tenants. And that's when we really grew the business. And at that point, we moved from just hard goods to doing apparel, soft goods, and the whole year-round kind of lifestyle brand of Wind and Waves.
So, you know, I got to ask you now, because you still run, and I think Scully Interactive is still running, so the eBeans subscription service is still out there. You've got the Wind and Wave store, which I love. I get all of my board shorts and t-shirts from you guys. It's such a find too, because you're like, how would you find a surf shop on Pine Street in Burlington? And it's great. You got great stuff in there. So you're doing that. You've got essentially a software side to your business, or the interactive side of the business. You've got Wind and Waves, and then you've also got I think it's two of the Spot restaurants. How are you doing all of those different things? How is it possible to manage retail, restaurant businesses? You're also, and we'll talk about it a little bit more, but increasingly more and more a commercial real estate developer as well. How are you in so many different places at once?
It's a great question. And the easy answer to that is you do it by having an incredibly awesome team working right alongside of you. And Roxanne and I are both, to a fault, we're not very hands-on owners, right? We love to empower our employees and managers and staff to the point where they really feel a strong feeling of ownership of everything they're involved in. You know, this is a great business practice that I think that people obviously talk about all the time, but I honestly believe that we're living proof that if you empower these employees, really make them feel like these decisions are their decisions, you back them up 100%, you can obviously, you know, you get to weigh in on the big decisions and ultimately, so you have ultimate final control, but they're walking the walk, they're managing and running these businesses as their own. And that really is what allows you to free up time to do more things. I never really wanted to be a big operator. You know, the more you build this momentum of like creating little things and watching them get going. And then once they get spinning and you feel like they're good to go, then you can spin up another one. And so I love this analogy of all these plates spinning, right? And it's some people, you know, accuse me of having like massive ADD, and it's not so much ADD, but it's kind of like, I believe that I'm here for a short period of time and I'm all about trying to get the most life experiences I can in the time that I have. So 2009, Roxanne and I are like, you know what? There's a lot of insanely popular breakfast restaurants in Burlington that are all wonderful. And the only frustration is that they're so hard to get into. On a Saturday or Sunday morning, trying to get into Sneakers or Penny Clues or any of the other places like in and around Burlington was challenging. So we looked at each other and, you know, we had built such a strong community in Santa Barbara around a little breakfast place there called the Mesa Cafe that we absolutely loved. And we were regulars there and we spent a lot of time there. And so at one point in 2009, when I was leaving, when I was starting to drift out of interactive or just kind of do less interactive work, there was this cool, iconic little gas station on Shelburne Road that was for sale. And it was only months after we'd purchased this first commercial real estate building on Pine Street. And it was only a block away. So it was really close. And that's the other thematic thing that's been really nice with all the things that Roxanne and I have done. They're all within like a 2 mile square radius of one another. So, and including our house. So I really believe strongly in consolidating all this stuff because ultimately we're community developers is the way I sort of think of ourselves. We're really more interested in building community than really building business. So anyway, that this cool little iconic gas station was for sale. I'd already had some momentum from buying the Pine Street building. The same commercial realtor approached me and said, hey, he kind of nudged me. I was like, hey, just in case you're still interested or still have an appetite, there's this cool little place. So I looked at that and I was like, that's our breakfast restaurant. And we bought that. That's a crazy wild story of just getting that whole place going. But transforming that gas station into the Spot was one of the most exciting business ventures to date, I think, that I've ever been a part of. It was really, really fun. And we got to, you know, design a menu, rebuild the whole thing. And that's the moment when I said, where somebody came up to me during the whole process of building that restaurant, they said, listen, we're at the process now where we have to pick a point of sale system. And I was like, okay. And so we started going through the early stages of that. And then it dinged. And then my, you know, this light bulb went off and I said, wait a minute, this point of sale thing is really not a lot more than a shopping cart from an e-commerce perspective. So that's when I said, like, listen, I think e-beans could actually fulfill this point of sale need for the restaurant. And we could do it in a kind of a cool, innovative way where it's paperless, put some monitors in the kitchen, have everybody in the kitchen kind of retrained to start reading orders off of a screen instead of these paper slips. And that was the genesis of e-beans as a point of sale system. And so we ran it there. We went through a lot of pains initially of just like getting it right and getting everything working correctly. And then ultimately we started hitting our flow where we started adding features and making things more efficient and making things better and customizing it for our workflow and our process. And that was really, really fun. But to go back to your question, John, sorry, the most important thing, honestly, is having an amazing team behind you, whether it's at The Spot, at Wind & Waves, at Hula, wherever it may be, and having those people be passionate about what they're doing. And then ultimately, that frees you up to do whatever you do. But it requires the entrepreneur and the founder to really have the ability to let go. And I was okay with letting go because you never really completely let go. But for me, I was always kind of interested in like, all right, what's next? What's next? What's next?
Yeah. And so I think that's so interesting, too, that you kind of saw the intersection between what you were doing in the restaurant side and what turned out to be a really good technology solution that you were able to adapt to that world. So just as a side note, did you then ultimately have a spinoff of eBeans into a POS system that you are now selling to other restaurants to use the same way you are at The Spot?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Like at one point I was like, wait a minute, do we have a business here? Maybe we should sell this. And we started to. I started installing in a couple of restaurants. And I want to say also, it was not by any means the best point of sale system on the market. It was far from it. It was, you know, two people working on this, me being one of them, versus, you know, all these other enterprise systems are out there servicing thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of restaurants. So we weren't out there trying to be better than everyone, but at my core, I'm a storyteller. And at my core, I really wanted to go through this experience of being one of the few restaurant owners that actually built their own point of sale system. Like, that's got to be a pretty small group of people who can make that claim. And at the expense of and frustration of some of my staff who unfortunately had to go through this with me, you know, a lot of the people were like, hey, listen, we should swap out and go to a different enterprise system because we're scaling now. Like, we're up to 3 restaurants now. And every now and then I have to kind of go back and defend this decision to keep using eBeans because every now and then we get this reason or we get a few new hires who come on who say, hey, listen, it's probably time for us to move on to an enterprise system. And sometimes even my confidence wavers where like, yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right. It was a good run. It was a good run. But then I check myself and I go, wait a minute. That's not why I'm doing this. I'm doing this for the storytelling part of it. I'm doing it for the experience of doing it. And those are my goals. I'm not interested in trying to crank as much money or margin out of these restaurants as I can. That's not the motivating drive. Instead, it's like the storytelling and the life experience of being able to do all of this stuff and doing it kind of like on my terms. So here's an interesting story, right? So one of the guys who is a really big fan of The Spot is Trey Pecor, who owns The Spot on the Dock site where we operate The Spot on the Dock. And so he was a big fan of The Spot and The Spot menu. And he came to us one day and said, what do you guys think about running the restaurant at The Spot on the Dock? And originally I was all for it. And then poor Roxanne was like, no. To give you a little sense of her unfortunate perspective, like, I'm the yes man who's constantly saying yes to every new opportunity for the reasons I stated before. And Roxanne is like, when is enough enough? And that's kind of the challenge that she and I have together. But it keeps us in balance, keeps us in check. Roxanne said no 3 times. And finally, Trey sat down in front of both of us. And she agreed to do it. So, but when we did it, I got the same conversation came up, like, Russ, eBeans is not going to work. This is a totally different scale from 210 Shelburne Road. It's not going to be able to hold up to the volume. And to give you a sense, you know, we went through a bunch of construction at Spawn and Dock to build that place out from what it was, because we wanted to change the dynamics and the vibe and the culture of that site down there. We really wanted to make it more of a loungy, slow. We wanted to slow it down. It wasn't like handing drinks over 3 people deep at the bar and just trying to pump as much alcohol as possible. We were like, no, let's get some cool lounge music. Let's get some couches in here and let's slow it down with some signature drinks and just have a nice experience. That's what we built. That's not ultimately what people turned it into. What we found was instead we got this incredible South Beach vibe where the place was packed. I mean, the Spot on the Dock's been a fun story, but we built what the people always wanted. We built what they wanted. And they showed up and went bonkers. And so the first day, The first day of spotting the dock, we opened on a Thursday at 2 o'clock. And the reason we opened at 2 o'clock is because I finally told all the construction guys on the site to put their hammers down. I was like, guys, enough is enough. Like, you know, they were already weeks and weeks and weeks late on the construction. And not to their fault. I mean, they were just whatever. It was a big project and it just dragged out longer. And these guys were being perfectionists and trying to get everything just right before we opened. The problem was it's an open air environment. So we had people literally just walking by every day, checking in on the progress of the restaurant. And there's no walls or anything. So they can see everything that's going on. They would ask the guys, like, there's a guy at a chop saw cutting a piece of lumber. And someone will be like, hey, when are you opening? And and those guys used to answer, be like, the new date's Tuesday. We're opening Tuesday. And I'd say, stop telling them when we're opening. Like, you guys are just, you're shooting yourselves in the foot. Like, don't tell them anything. So anyway, the word got out that it was going to be Thursday. And this crowd started gathering. And now it's 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, approaching 2 o'clock. And finally, I just said, time out, guys. Put the hammers down. Sweep up. Get out of here. We're opening right now. And we opened that day on a Thursday at 2 o'clock. And we did more in gross sales than we've ever done at the spot on 210 Shelburne Road. And so that, I was like, wow, here we go. Then day two, we doubled that number. Then day three, we tripled that number. Then day four, we literally quadrupled the number of the best day we've ever had at Shelburne Road. And on the fifth day, the kitchen came out to the deck there in the morning and just said, listen, it's Sunday. We have no food left. We can't place an order right now because everyone's closed. We're exhausted. We can't keep this up. We've got to like close for a couple days and just regroup. So we did that. And that's when we made some changes. Like, we got rid of breakfast. We're like, we can't do three meals a day. That's just impossible. But again, it was like one of those experiences. It was like really, really exciting. We had the benefit of a great partner with Trey and his whole crew. And we had a fantastic location that anybody would be envious of. And we were able to really elevate the brand of the spot at that point. And ultimately, E-Beans, you know, kept up with the pace and did a great job throughout that whole summer. And we're still using it down there today.
Oh, no way. No way. And that, so I think I remember, I think we were there the first summer. Was it 2017 that you opened Spot on the Dock? Was it that summer?
Yes. I think that's
so.
Right.
Yeah. So I remember, I mean, awesome spot for all of our listeners. You could not pick a better spot for exactly like you said, a lounge scene bar. The only downside is when you pull your boat in there, it's a really stressful spot to dock your boat with everybody out there watching you, giving you tips while they're drinking. So it's, I mean, it doesn't get much better. And where our office here is like literally right across the street. We're on Battery Street. So we're right across the street from the spot on the dock.
And
I know you guys are doing some construction there now. It always amazes me because every time I turn around, I know, you know, with Hula and this, you've got more things under construction all the time. What are you guys doing to Spot on the Dock right now?
Well, this is really Trey's vision, and he's got some really exciting plans for that whole marina area, and he just keeps adding more and more boat slips. He's doing an amazing job of building out the waterfront down there, and he's got sort of a big grand vision for that whole area. I mean, he owns something like 5 acres down there, right where the ferry dock is, and he's changing his perspective on what all that space should be used for. And so, you know, they closed the ferry service to Port Kent out of that location. So they're not running a ferry boat out of downtown anymore. So that opened up sort of the north side of Spot on the Dock for us. Because before then, there was this, you know, massive two-story steel wall of the ferry boat right there on the north side of the dock. And now that that's gone, it's really opened up the view. That side of the building for us had been sort of the unsightly sort of recycling and bar back and storage area for cases of beer and recycling and so on. Now it became much more of a customer facing side, because now we've got these, you know, he has some of his nicer, bigger boat customers, docking customers backed into those slips right there on the north side of the building where the ferry used to be. And so he came to us and said, all right, guys, we got to get the bar to wrap around now in a horseshoe fashion so that that whole view opens up. And so that now we can take more patrons on the north side of the building. And it also allows us to add additional tables and chairs to the east side of the building, because now you can walk around and get over to the east side. And so for him, he's like, you know, he's all about go, 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 go. Talk about an entrepreneur. That guy's on fire. So he really kind of encouraged us to do it. At the time, I was like, listen, dude, I'm exhausted from the Hula construction. Last thing I want to do is start cracking into this nut right now. Like, what we have is working great. But he persuaded us to do it in a friendly way. And we were like, you know what? In the long term, this is going to be awesome. We're talking about the summer coming out of COVID. So it's going to be gangbusters down there anyway. And if we can help spread people out and create some more room, we should do it now.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And I think, yeah, that's a common theme for you. You're helping out with all the crowded restaurants by opening up more space for everyone. I always appreciate it. You can always seem to get a table inside, outside, somewhere at the spots. So that's great. So let's shift gears here to Hula. I'm so impressed with what you're doing. I went and looked at it. And when you drive up, you don't know what you're rolling into. And then all of a sudden, it kind of opens up to you. And it's just like mind-blowing the size of what you're building right on the shores of Lake Champlain. So just tell everyone, what was the vision behind it? And how did you even get involved in it, building what essentially is a really high-end co-working campus?
I'm blown away. My expectations have been incredibly beyond exceeded in like every facet of this project. But it started off, and I wrote a little blog about this. It's on the Hula website, so you can, for anyone who's interested, they can read that. But it all started with like, you know, riding my bike back and forth past this amazing facility for so many years, just, and particularly with a real emphasis and interest in getting on the water there. That beach is insanely amazing in terms of its access, and just, it's sandy, it's got proximity to downtown Burlington. And at the time, you know, I was also on the board of the Burlington Business Association. So I've been really well versed on a lot of the economic challenges that Burlington and the rest of Vermont really face. And, you know, I felt like, hey, there might be an opportunity to do something about that. And being involved in different startup companies and really being close to that whole interactive world, I really kind of saw the value and benefit of these explosive growth companies. And particularly Dealer.com, you know, and like Dealer.com and the guys who started that, obviously they deserve a lot of credit for what they did to bolster things in specifically in Burlington. They really drove a lot of job growth. They really drove all sorts of new blood for people who wanted to move to Vermont to go work at Dealer. It's a fascinating story. And even from those various exits that have come out of Dealer.com, a lot of those original founders have since launched new startup companies. So that's the kind of circular activity you want to see with a lot of these companies that end up raising a lot of money, doing really well, punching out, and then ultimately starting something else. And that's the kind of sustainability model that you really want to see. And they've done an amazing job. The one threat that I always saw was like, oh God, what if Dealer were to ever to leave Burlington? That would be tough. And we almost saw it happen with, you know, two different acquisitions. I think it was on everybody's mind. It was probably something that, you know, it wasn't a very comfortable thing to talk about, but I'm sure people were thinking like, wow, if they were to leave, that'd be a pretty empty footprint that was left behind. So I'm like, well, what do we do? Well, we really need to de-risk that problem by creating more startup companies or trying to get companies to move to Burlington. And ultimately, you know, and I talked to some of the recruiters even at Dealer.com, and they're like, one of the big challenges we have is this whole trailing spouse or plus one problem, where they might do a great job of recruiting somebody they really want, but if their spouse can't find a job, you know, that's going to be a problem. Or say they are successful recruiting somebody, but that person's a little bit concerned, like, hey, if things don't work out, what kind of lateral move do I have in Burlington, or do I have to move again? Without a lot of lateral movement, it became a risk for anybody who might be willing to move here. So for all those reasons, on top of all the other kind of challenges that our state faces with our low population, I felt like the greatest gift that we can give to Burlington right now is really help create a sustainable economic model. And the best way I could think of to do that is creating jobs, but creating the kind of jobs that we really wanted. And, you know, Burlington has a great brand all by itself. We crank out politicians, we crank out amazing companies, we crank out fascinating products in the food business and in other industries. So there's a lot of things that the Burlington brand is already doing to work in our favor. I felt like if we could bring some industries to Vermont that have sort of the same mission and values as a lot of those baked in Burlington and Vermont brands, they would actually work well together. So this Blodgett campus was really one of the few places that offered the scale to really do something like this in a meaningful way. Because there was already some amazing groups in town, and still are obviously, that are doing this work every day and have been doing this work for a long time. And they're great. The difference with Hula, in my opinion, is that we had an opportunity to take over this campus and really put some muscle and scale behind this initiative. And I feel like that's what we've been able to do.
Yeah, and I think what is really interesting about it is, you know, we started, when I opened up my company here, I started in the Karma Birdhouse, which is a cool place for a small business. You know, we had like a 1-2 person office in there. But what you're doing, the scale at what you're doing and the size of businesses that you can accommodate kind of takes it to a different level. Because, you, I mean, some of the tenants you have, or the, I guess you probably call them members at Hula, some of the member companies there are some of the more notable companies in Vermont right now.
Yeah, and you know, that's that really speaks to the curation process. Early on in this project, there was like I met Rob Lair, and Rob Lair has been the most valuable addition to this whole Hula project since the beginning. And Rob, it was great to have someone to be able to bounce ideas off of and validate the ideas and concepts that I had, and in a way where we were completing each other's sentences and we were so on board with sort of this common vision for what we need to do. And Rob really helped give me the confidence to really move forward with this vision that this could be done and help show me how it could be done. A couple of things he mentioned was the curation was going to be really important, trying to find companies that were growing fast. And ultimately that was going to get us to our mission even sooner. So that was really important to us, to find those kinds of companies. Secondly, he said, listen, it's one thing to create an incubator. It's another thing to have an incubator with a fund. So he's like, we should set aside some money to be able to invest in these companies, because ultimately they're going to need to be capitalized in order to hit their growth targets. And the most important part there is that we wanted to be able to close the rounds that these companies were raising in state. And so the reason for that, right, is because we're really vulnerable when a company is trying to raise a certain amount of money. If they get some of it in Vermont, but they can't get it all, if they can't complete the round in Vermont, they've got to look elsewhere. And they're going to go out to the usual suspects of other venture capital companies and cities around North America, whatever. That opens us up to the risk of any of those outside firms eventually following up their investment with a future investment that gives them the leverage to pull that company out of Vermont. So if we close the round in Vermont, we've got Vermont dollars working on Vermont companies, and we don't have any of those outside influences putting any kind of pressure on any of these guys to leave Vermont. So, but in order to do that, we had to go out and find the appetite for private equity investment. So what Hula really allowed us to do is it gave us not only the brand presence, but it gave us the physical confidence. People understood there was brick and mortar behind this mission. That was really important for people to understand. Like, this is not a virtual group of investors getting together to help promote Vermont. This was, you know, we had put our stake in the sand. We put real money behind it. We were fully committed and fully in this game. And that allowed us to go and knock on doors and say, listen, we're Hula. Here's what we're doing. We're interested in sharing opportunities to invest in Vermont companies with you. And we'd love for you to participate. But we did it in a way that was very inclusive. We're not asking anyone to invest in our fund directly. We're just asking you to invest alongside of us so that we can help complete these rounds and introduce these companies to more and more investors. And a lot of these people were like angel investors who, you know, would participate in various investment opportunities that were presented to them through their own word of mouth networks. What Hula has really done is created an opportunity for anyone in that space. If you're an angel investor, if you're an astute investor that's interested in participating in Vermont opportunities, now you have a place to go, you have a person you can contact, you understand the rules of the game, and you can participate anytime you want to. And Rob Lair really brought that vision and that opportunity to Hula.
Yeah, that aspect of it is fascinating, because I think you're 100% right that when company might be a great startup, they build in the Burlington area, as soon as they get investors in one of these big cities somewhere, they're trying to move them closer to them or closer to that large market. And this is a really interesting way to get these good companies to stay here even after they've grown and hit that next level. So for people who are listening, if they are investors in Vermont, can they look at the fund? Can they get involved and invest alongside the fund in what you guys are doing? Is that something that's open to any investor?
Yes, absolutely. Like I said, it's very inclusive. And so what you know, all they would have to do is come to our website, send us a note, or contact rob@hulalakeside.com. Rob Lair, if anyone's interested. You know, the other thing, John, I just want to say is like during that time, which is really fun, is that you mentioned some of the companies. And, you know, I think Rob would say the same thing. We feel incredibly fortunate that our timing was almost in lockstep with the development of some of the most interesting companies coming out of Vermont right now. So as we're launching Hula, these companies are just starting to hit their stride and they're going through their very early sort of seed round seed round, investment rounds at the same time that we're launching our fund. So we had the opportunity to participate, but also bring awareness to these companies from this larger investment community. And one of them is Benchmark Space, started by Ryan McDevitt, who's the founder, who's a Vermont native, who went to UVM, who's creating, you know, next generation propulsion systems for small satellites. And what's really attractive to me about this is that this whole small satellite market has got this hockey stick curve in terms of its forecasting of growth. And Ryan and his team are literally a bolt on to that industry, and they've created a technology that is far superior to anything else that's out there in regards to satellite propulsion. So these satellites all live in a shallow orbit around the planet, and that shallow orbit does have like a slow gravitational pull on it. So any small satellites in that orbit eventually deorbit and they burn up. So Brian and his team have figured out a way to actually extend the life of those small satellites like 3 to 5x. And that's one significant chunk of business that they're working on, and they're doing great. And Ryan is considered, you know, one of the best and brightest people in that industry right now. And he's the kind of guy that people want to hear from in the industry. When they go to trade shows, I'm told that Ryan's booth is loaded with people who want to talk to him. And so to have not only these industries in Vermont, but also have the leaders of these industries in Vermont is incredibly opportunistic for us. At the same time they were launching, there's this other great story that everyone knows about now, but it was Beta. And, you know, the founder of Beta is Kyle Clark, and Kyle and Rob both live in Underhill. They know each other. And so right at the time Rob is starting this fund, he's like, hey, listen, the other company we should look at is this really exciting electronic vertical takeoff and landing aircraft company coming from this guy, Kyle Clark. The short story is that basically we got a meeting with Kyle. They had a great contract in place with their original customer who carved out in a beautiful strategy for rolling out the first aircraft. Ultimately, I think Kyle was interested in kind of accelerating their development so that they could kind of keep, because they had a really strong sense that they were outpacing everyone else in the industry. And he really wanted to keep that momentum and keep that hedge. So he's like, listen, let's go out and try to raise some money and hire some more people. So we got a meeting with him to kind of hear what they were looking to do. And ultimately, they were looking to raise a little bit of money. And so Rob raised his hand and said, Kyle, give us a crack at this. Let us take a shot at it. And at that time, they were trying to raise somewhere between like $5 and $7 million. That was the other really strong opportunity that Rob had to go out and really meet every single investor pretty much in this area. And he said, listen, we've got a great story here with Beta. We'd love to tell you about it and we'd love to have your participation. So ultimately, you know, I think we raised about $30 million in 30 days, which demonstrated to us not only that the Beta story was a really compelling story, but it also demonstrated to us that there is capacity in Vermont and that we had an opportunity to tap into that and really bring people to the table and explain to them about this new investment concept and this new initiative around helping small businesses in Burlington.
You're talking about a couple of industries that I don't think people think of Burlington in their head, like aerospace. I mean, you've got like a legitimate rocket scientist working right there in Hula developing cutting edge technology. And those are some industries that I don't think people ever would look to Burlington for. Is that one of the challenges that you're seeing, or is that one of the things that's most exciting to you to say, hey, we can kind of flip the script here and show that any type of business could be scaled even in a small city like ours?
I think it's actually an advantage. It's opportunistic for us. It's disruptive for us as a state. You're right. We all have some work to do to break down the stereotypes of how people see Vermont from outside of Vermont, right? And this is a great opportunity for us to do that. Since, I mean, the news, and I know this is going to air sometime later, but the news as of today of Beta, you know, Beta just announced their UPS contract a few days ago, which is a huge win for them. So Beta issued a press release announcing the fact that they're buying 10 ships from Beta. And that is huge because up until that point, you know, Beta had been somewhat flying underneath the radar a little bit. I mean, they've been leaking a little bit of press coverage through Wired magazine specifically. But this hit the mainstream wires of CNBC and every other Wall Street money news organization. And now Beta is front and center on a lot of people's minds as this new emerging industry that ultimately reflects on Burlington and Vermont. And it breaks down those stereotypical views of what people would otherwise think is happening up in Vermont. And there's parallels to this, right? There's I mean, to bring it back to my little world, it's like, why did you create a surf shop in Vermont? It's a landlocked state. It's a landlocked state. There's no ocean access from Vermont. But you know what? It makes people stop and think. And from a brand development and marketing standpoint, it's not a bad approach sometimes to come out and do the thing that's like that's not expected. It's the same reason we called it Hula. You know, Hula, we could have called it the Lakefront Economic Development Center. And it would have been very descriptive and everyone would have been a little bit clearer on like what we were doing. But we wanted to be more disruptive than that. We wanted people to pause and think and to displace this concept of what they expect to hear versus what they actually hear. And for me, it's been really fun to have that juxtaposition from a branding standpoint of doing things that are more unexpected and getting that reaction that's a lot different than delivering what people anticipate.
Yeah. I think that's interesting. And it's a common theme in everything you've been doing. So for anyone listening, why Hula? What's the meaning behind the name for you?
Hula, it definitely plays towards all the water sports and surf theme stuff that we've been doing all along. But Hula for me was really all about coming up with a name that would make people stop and just go, huh. It's also, you know, naming is a really challenging thing to go through. I know you've had to experience this yourself, but coming up with a name is no trivial thing. It's difficult. And there's all kinds of factors that come into play. And some of the ones that are most important are, can you remember it easily? Is it easy to pronounce? The thing I liked about Hula is it rolls off the tongue. It is easy to say. It's easy to remember. And when you experience it and tell someone else, you're not going to have a hard time remembering what it was. There's a nice layout of letters there. The consonant, vowel kind of layout of the actual... From a branding standpoint, from a word mark standpoint, it's very, very strong and it's small, it's short. And again, it's not what you would expect. It's not the kind of thing that people would necessarily associate with an incubator space.
Yeah. I was thinking it was because of hula hoop and quality of life, fun with work. And so I guess everybody makes their own connections, but that's what's great about the name, right? Like it's so unique and it's easy to say, it's easy to remember. So yeah, kudos on the naming. Yeah, I know I've done a really bad job of naming products and companies through my my career. I've been fired from those jobs over the years.
John, it's hard. You know that. It's hard. The first decision you have to make is this going to be a descriptive name or is this going to be a completely random, unassociative name? And then you kind of go down those two paths and you sort of figure out what you're going to do. But it's not easy. And eventually, once you hear it, and it sort of rings in your head, you go, that's the one. But it's a challenging exercise regardless.
And so the last thing I want to talk to you about, and it's amazing that you even have time to do this, but the Sea Change event you just hosted, I think it was a huge success. You got some really great keynote speakers. And tell us just what it was all about, why the Sea Change event's so important, and how people can find out more about it.
You know, Sea Change really kind of was born out of the opportunities to really host events here at Hula. One of the things we built into the Hula programming and the physical space was a large event center. And we did that because for the same reason we designed Hula the way we did, where it's all one ground floor and a lot of glass, is we wanted to really open up lines of sight so that you're having spontaneous conversations with people throughout the day that you didn't anticipate. And that's where the magic happens, is people running into each other throughout the day and being able to make visual contact with another, saying, oh, there's so-and-so, I got to go ask him a question. And that sort of connectivity is really, I feel like that's our job as an incubator, to make those connections. And so one of the things we wanted to make sure we built into the Hula footprint was this event space. And we wanted to build the event space that didn't exist already in Vermont. So we wanted to be able to invite conferences, industry and corporate conferences to Vermont that we normally get passed on because we just don't have the space to facilitate those. So ultimately it came down to building this large event space where we can seat 500 people, full catering in the whole nine yards with AV and everything to back it up. So I said, listen, the best way to demonstrate this event space is for us to put on our own event and just demonstrate what the capacity can look like. And I said, if we're going to do an event, we should do an event that's core to our mission, which is really about sustainability and protecting the environment. And that's a topic that's very near and dear to mine and my wife Roxanne's heart. We really believe strongly. We live up here, obviously, for the lifestyle and for the outdoors, and we really want to, you know, use some of our good fortune in a way to help give back or help to promote innovation that helps to improve some of the damages that have been done to the planet. And so one of the thoughts that we had is, if we're going to put on an event like this and really demonstrate the features and facets of Hula, let's do it in a way where we're benefiting an environmental cause. So around the time we came up with this idea, it was clear, like based on the calendar, that we were going to roll this out in the wintertime. And so we said, there's no better group that I can think of to support than Protect Our Winters, and which is all about climate change and snow sport industry, which obviously plays directly into the branding and messaging of Vermont. So it made sense to host an event like this here. Now, and then we, like everyone, we had the COVID challenges of having to shift gears and go from a completely in-person event to now a completely virtual event. And fortunately, you know, going back to the value of partners and staff and so on, we found a really great partner in Signal Kitchen and Alex Lally and his whole team. And those guys came to the table, even when we were designed to be in person, and they said, listen, we'd love to help you guys put this thing on and ultimately help you with future events. So kudos to those guys, did an amazing job finding us a virtual platform to host this thing once everything went 100% virtual. The other silver lining that COVID gave us was the fact that one of our tenants and members that we've had since the beginning that we absolutely love is 1% for the Planet. And 1% for the Planet couldn't hold their annual conference because of COVID. Neither could Protect Our Winters. So a lot of people were just taking the year off, as we all had to do. Everybody was making compromises because of this pandemic. But we came to them and say, hey, listen, we're new to town. We're a brand new concept. We're new to town. We're interested in putting on an event to benefit Protect Our Winters. Could you help us with speakers and content? We're not looking for sponsorship dollars in year one. We're looking for assistance in creating content and bringing speakers to the platform. And 1% just absolutely could not have been more helpful and supportive in that process. And essentially for them, it helped to fill that gap that was left from having to take the year off due to COVID. So we essentially created a framework that allowed them to still have a presence of some sort of messaging that they were eager to fill. And so one of the first announcements we were able to make early on was that Yvonne Chouinard, the founder of Patagonia, was going to be our keynote speaker. And at that point, we were off to the races. And thank you to Ryan, to Kate Williams, and to everyone at 1% for putting that kind of muscle behind this inaugural first year event, because there's something to be said for having that kind of star power on year one in your first go around that just builds confidence when you go and talk to every other partner that you want to invite into this process. And so having that baseline to start with just gave us the opportunity to just roll with additional partner commitments that just became easier and easier. And before I knew it, every week we had an announcement of some other national brand that felt really good about environmental sustainability, about the message of what we were delivering, and they really wanted to get behind it. And again, I think COVID really helped us with this because it limited distractions that would have otherwise prevented them from participating in year one. Imagine, like, this is the first time we're doing this. We're going out and making calls to these big brands like Parley for the Oceans, Burton Snowboards, Sierra Nevada, Bank of the West, and a host of other people that all got behind this in a really big way. And they all provided speakers and content in a way that we could upload to this amazing platform called Hopin. And we delivered this 2-day virtual summit. And I got to tell you, and I know you got to participate and some of your staff got to participate, but I got to say, like, I was there for every hour of those 2 days watching and participating. And I was blown away by how seamless and smooth the whole process went. And, you know, even after we wrapped up on the last day with the last keynote from Yvonne and Kate and Kate's interview with Yvonne, you know, our rep from Hopin chimed in and said, guys, I got to tell you, this is the best event I've ever seen on our platform. And when we heard that, we knew we had something special.
Yeah, no, I love what you did with it too. And that's what my whole team is saying also. It was just so well executed. And it's just great, like everything, it's great to see that quality of event with those types of speakers coming out of Burlington. It's not what people expect. And I think that's so great. Now, so you have another one coming up. Did you say it's going to be sometime this summer?
Yeah. Thanks, John. The Yeah, so our plan is to host these twice a year. We're going to start to thread this back into being more in person, the way we initially designed it, but with a virtual sort of they're calling these things like hybrid events now. So it's like a hybrid of virtual and in person. So we'll have a hybrid approach this summer. It'll be a sea change summer. It's going to happen near the end of July is the kind of the target date for this. And we're already guns a-blazing, like working on this next one. And we've already got amazing commitments from existing and additional partners. And this one is going to be really water focused with a heavy dose of single use plastic and some of the solutions around single use plastic and use of single use plastic. And I'm really excited about this one. I'm excited about the momentum that we have. And, you know, it's really almost created a whole nother project that we didn't even see coming. I mean, we did this as a way of just kind of demonstrating and experimenting and showing off kind of our event space. And now it's turned into its own living and breathing branded organism that now we realize has some legs to it. And we're really excited about it.
Yeah, that's so cool. It's so interesting just to see how that came to life. And really, you do have beautiful event space, and it is something that Burlington didn't really have and couldn't host big events like this. So it's great to see. If people want to learn more about that, because it is a hybrid event, so no matter where you are, you can tune in and watch it, and it's a great experience virtually. But also, if you're here in the Burlington area or nearby, you can come in person. How do they find out more about it? Is there a website to go to?
Yeah, so the website is seachangesessions.com, S-E-E, changesessions.com, sorry. And right now, we've got all of our winter content up there. We're actually working right now on releasing all of the content from the winter session onto our YouTube channel. So you can search Sea Change Sessions on YouTube to see all of that. And then, yeah, stay tuned. You can sign, you can opt in to a newsletter at Sea Change to get notified on the dates for the summer one. And then ultimately, when those tickets go on sale, you'll be notified that way.
Oh, that's awesome. So for everyone, check out seachangesessions.com. That's S-E-E, changesessions.com. And if you're interested in just following Russ and everything that they're doing over at Hula, it's hulalakeside.com. You can learn more about the fun there. You can check out the space. And I recommend checking out your blog posts, because they capture what life is like here in Burlington. So thank you for your writing and, you know, the storytelling and just everything you're doing for the community here.
Yeah, thanks, John. And I'll give one more plug if you don't mind. But like, if you like the writing, there's I'd love to point you also to this. There's a water sports magazine that we are involved in publishing called Stand Up Journal. And if you haven't seen that, be on the lookout for that. It's a quarterly. It's a beautiful piece that we produce right here. Jeff Henderson, who's the creative director of basically every brand that Roxanne and I are involved with, does an incredible job. He's an amazingly talented designer. And I will say just quickly, like, one of the things that's so wonderful about all the stuff that we're able to do is that we're able to do our own sort of in-house design work, like branding and design. And that falls on Jeff, and Jeff does an incredible job. He's a dear, dear friend of mine. We do every single water sport together. We're like brothers from different mothers, and so like-minded, and both of us have such a strong passion around all the stuff we do. And to be able to do all this marketing and messaging with your friend who's literally in the room with you every single day, that's another huge reason why a lot of this magic happens, is being able to do it in that way.
Oh, that's awesome. So that's Stand Up Journal?
Standupjournal.com.
Awesome. Standupjournal.com. Definitely check it out. Russ, thank you so much for being here with us today, helping us kick off this Learning Life Local series on Burlington, Vermont. I couldn't think of a better person to have here for the first episode.
I'm flattered, John. Thanks so much for having me, and great job.
All right. Thank you, man. And thanks to all of our listeners for being here every week. As you know, we have a new episode that comes out each Tuesday, and next week we'll be welcoming Michael Lee to the show.
Don't hide your idea. Don't be scared about somebody stealing your idea. That doesn't exist anymore. Ideas are a dime a dozen. It's all about execution. So whatever idea you have, go and share it and sell that idea.
He's the CEO of Reconciled right here in Burlington, Vermont. So we're excited to have you back for another one. And until our next episode, happy learning.